Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is combating climate change. With me to discuss what role technologies like nuclear power, carbon capture, or solar geoengineering might play in combating climate change and what risks and dangers they could pose is Gernot Wagner. Gernot is a climate economist at the Columbia Business School. His work focuses on climate risks and climate policy. He has written four books, the most recent of which is Geoengineering: The Gamble. He also writes a monthly column for Project Syndicate on climate change. Gernot, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to begin our conversation with two broad observations. The first is that our climate is changing and the consequences are potentially catastrophic. We see the signs all about us. Europe is currently experiencing its most intense drought in 500 years. Pakistan has the opposite problem, torrential rain and flooding that has already killed more than 1,000 people. A study released earlier this week concluded that the melting of the Greenland ice sheet will cause oceans to rise by nearly a foot by the end of the century, which would put low-lying coastal areas, think Florida as well as Bangladesh, underwater. Second observation is that despite all of the international summits, all of the agreements and vows by world leaders, the emission of the heat-trapping gases that drive climate change continues to rise. In all, we seem to be playing out the dynamic captured in St. Augustine's famous prayer, "Give me chastity and continence, but not yet." So, Gernot, is it time for us to rethink our approach to combating climate change by leaning more heavily on nuclear energy, developing technology to remove carbon from the atmosphere, or take a shot at solar geoengineering?
Yes and no. And let me start with a no. So, I mean, yes, things are bad. Frankly, things are bad and much, much worse than most of us predicted. Right? So this Greenland study you just mentioned, it wasn't too long ago that, frankly, most of us, of course, understood that the poles are melting and sea levels are rising. But then when you added it up, Greenland, summer sea ice is melting, and that's a real problem. But the Greenland ice sheet itself isn't going to contribute all that much to sea level rise this century. Nah. Right now, to be clear, right, it was never a question of if New York City is going to be underwater. It's a question of when, right? But of course, you know, when matters. If it's thousands of years from now, happening within a millennium, yes, that's a problem. But of course, not as big a problem as 10 million, 30 million by some counts in Pakistan right now, directly affected by massive, massive floods, 1,000 people dead, right? Not a future event, happening now, happening this week, right? Climate change is hitting home. On the other side, and this is the optimist in me, there is this clean energy race that is happening much, much faster, significantly faster than also most of us predicted not too long ago.
But the issue isn't whether it's happening faster than we predicted. It's whether it's happening fast enough to blunt the change in the climate.
Of course. And no, it is not. That said, yes, there are negative tipping points, right? Negative climatic tipping points. That's the Greenland ice sheet collapsing completely and so on and so forth. There are also positive ones. There are positive socioeconomic ones. There are all these facts around, look, we are installing more solar PV this year than the International Energy Agency predicted would happen by 2030, 5 years ago, right? So the prediction 5 years ago said, you know, we are massively ramping up solar PV deployment, solar photovoltaic, and this massive increase will lead to amazing deployment by the end of the decade. We are there right now already. And this is the hopeful side. This is the optimistic side that no, it's not just carbon removal, solar geoengineering. Yes, we need that too, potentially. Potentially the solar geoengineering bit, carbon removal. Yes, we need that. We pretty much know that already. But there is still so much on the clean energy front.
So let's play out that positive story, Gernot, on the clean energy front. To what extent do the provisions in the recently passed Inflation Reduction Act make a difference, both domestically in the United States, but potentially broader overseas?
Right, and that's one of these tipping points, right? It is the biggest climate investment in U.S. history. And by the way, when you sort of just sort of go through the numbers here, sort of the headline figure many of us are familiar with is this $369 billion over 10 years in clean energy investment. Turns out there is another $100 billion in loans to EV production, electric vehicle battery production facilities. And the Department of Energy is getting $250 billion in additional loan authority to lend to clean energy efforts. That's another $350 billion right there, almost doubling this headline figure of invest. And of course, right, whether it's the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end, I'll let others chime in on this one, but it's just the beginning, right? It is just the very first time that we at the national level invest heavily in this clean energy race. And yes, it's a race, right?
How is it a race? Is it a race against time or is it a race against other countries?
It's both. Right. So let's start with the race against other countries. Right. So actually, it was The Economist, the magazine, that put from petrostate to electrostate on its cover a couple of years ago. And as some of the headline figures in there, and of course, they've only gotten bigger since, China produces over 2/3 of all solar panels produced globally, over 2/3, 70% of all lithium ion batteries produced globally in any given year are produced or manufactured in China. Almost half of wind turbines in China, right? Okay, so, I mean, that's the electrostate right there. A massive, massive industrial policy effort to win the race for the technologies of the future. And yes, China has been leading the charge on the supply side, right? Europe arguably has been leading the charge on the demand side. And the US in many ways at the national level has been sitting on the sidelines. Well, it just entered that race in a big way. And of course, right, it's only really a race if other countries are not just sitting there watching and sort of applauding, saying, hey, finally, welcome, but in fact are doubling down themselves. And we see some of that, right? So actually before the Inflation Reduction Act passed, I would have argued, and many of us argued and saw in the data, this real transatlantic divergence in how we reacted to Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Lots happening in Europe, very little on the clean energy front happening at the national level in the US. At least nothing really in addition to what had happened before. Well, suddenly the US entered this in a big way, right? So is it enough? No, it is not, right? We're still losing the battle against time, the battle against climate change, unmitigated climate change. But, well, those are the positive tipping points, right? Those are the socioeconomic ones where heat pumps, electric vehicles are still, frankly, to this day, right? The sort of thing that, you know, some of us invest in, some of us do, some of us are willing to take the step. Look, it's not going to take long for heat pumps, well-insulated buildings, electric vehicles to be the default, right? To basically be the sort of thing that, hey, that's just what you do.
You write a lot about heat pumps, Gernot. What do you mean by that and why are they significant? My guess is most people in the United States are not familiar with what a heat pump is or does.
It's a refrigerator you can run in reverse. So you can also use it to heat your home, right? Or, you know, sort of the flippant version is sort of it's an air conditioner, but it's actually the functioning is sort of closer to a fridge, if you will. But it's basically a way to heat and cool your apartment, your home, your office with the same gadget, the same pump, called the heat pump that replaces your air conditioner on the one hand and replaces typically the gas furnace on the other.
And it uses less energy?
It uses a lot less energy. It's electric, right? Sort of, you know, the name of the game, right, in this clean energy race basically is insulate, insulate, insulate. Electrify, electrify, electrify. And then, of course, you need to decarbonize the electric grid, right? That's a key component, of course, too. But actually, even if the entire grid ran on natural gas in this case, it's still better to then use an electric heat pump to cool and warm your home than to burn gas directly in your home, right? So in this electrification business, yeah, heat pumps play a major role. And then, of course, right, sort of the final step, if you will, doesn't use a lot of gas, turns out, but the final step to not need to burn any gas in your home is then to switch your stove, right, from the gas range to the induction stove. And in many ways, you know, that's the gold standard, as it were. And it's increasingly becoming the norm, right? The Inflation Reduction Act subsidizes those heat pumps to the tune of something like $8,000 per home, per heat pump. And by the way, subsidizes it by way of a rebate, right? Not a tax credit you may or may not get come April 15th of next year, but you get it right then and there when you buy the thing.
Now, one question for you, Gernot, because I've heard a lot of people talking about the green energy transition, talk about the cost, but they also talk about constraints or choke points. That as you move to green energy, you need access to more minerals that you hadn't previously used. They're in short supply. We talk a lot about rare earth minerals and things like that. Is that a real sort of choke point in this transition to green technology?
It is not. It is not at this point. And it is not in the sense that we are not anywhere close to hitting any of these limits. And frankly, like, yeah, we see some of this sometimes, right? This is sort of the birthing woes of a new industry, of course, right? So there is a shortage in a particular component, and then it turns out we innovate our way out of it. And when you look at the overall trends, solar PV, of course, is sort of the one most of us know about, and it costs now a tenth of what it did 10 years ago. It costs a hundredth of what it did 40 years ago when Jimmy Carter put solar panels on the White House, right? And 5 years later, Ronald Reagan took him down, right? Nobody's going to take down a solar panel right now because it is the cheapest form of electricity in history. And yes, solar PV did increase in price slightly this year over last year, right? Like so many other things did. And yes, shortages in some components are partly to blame. But the increase from last year to this year, around 20%. Increase in the alternatives, fossil energy, tenfold, right? Triple, quadruple, tenfold in Europe, right? Natural gas prices. So in other words, the price that actually matters, the relative price, solar PV is even cheaper this year than the fossil alternative.
But you're going to need a lot more lithium. Do we face constraints in terms of access to lithium? I take your point that scientists, given enough time, can find substitutions, maybe find a different chemical that will allow you to have even more efficient battery, but that can take time.
It does, and up to a point. So yes, right? So if you will, there's a race between fossilflation and greenflation, right? So there's this European central banker, Isabella Schnabel, who has introduced those two terms. And actually, before the invasion, before February 24th, gave it the speech where she introduced both terms and basically voiced her concern about greenflation. And I can tell you, to her full credit, almost immediately after, she came out swinging and said, look, the reason for the inflation right now, the inflation we see right now, is in fact increase in fossil fuel prices, is fossilflation. And yes, there's always going to be, right, components of the batteries are getting more expensive, or right now, right, electric vehicles are extremely expensive in the sense that you part pay above manufacturer suggested retail prices because there's just so much demand right now for these things. Well, it turns out that EVs, batteries, renewables for that matter, are in fact all technologies, and in so many ways, technologies can only get cheaper over time, right? We get better at doing this stuff. We get better at producing the battery. We find alternatives to lithium. We are more efficient in their use. Whereas the alternative, fossil fuels, are commodities, right? And, you know, it shouldn't surprise us anymore, 100 years or so into the oil age, that, yeah, those prices fluctuate wildly. And while, of course, we also get better at using limited resources up to a point, we use that us getting better of using limited resources to then, for example, drive bigger cars, right? SUVs and so on. And that in itself, of course, is a problem, and no, EVs aren't going to solve everything. But again, One is a technology, the other one a commodity. And I'm rather hopeful that we will figure out these technological questions, especially, of course, also because the sort of the international relations here just look very different from technology markets on the one hand versus commodity markets.
Karina, let's go back to where we started. And when I asked the first question about whether it was time to think differently, your answer was yes and no. And we've been talking so far about how there has been progress in the green energy transition, maybe even more than people appreciate. The Inflation Reduction Act, some other things are going to make that happen. But my takeaway is still that we're not in a situation in which that transition is happening fast enough. So this gets us into the question of what role should things like nuclear energy, carbon capture and storage, and solar radiation management, also known as geoengineering, play in the battle against climate change?
So first of all, I would say these three, of course, are very, very different, right? So nuclear is something, you know, we've decades worth of experience, very different responses in Germany, let's say, over the last decade, post-Fukushima accident versus the US and elsewhere, right? So lots of geopolitics, lots of intricate questions, and frankly, lots of historical perspective, right? That's one. But the second, carbon removal, still addresses the root cause, right? Not sort of directly the root cause as in too much CO2 emitted, but it addresses the problem of too much CO2 in the atmosphere. And yes, carbon removal, just like the name implies, means literally sucking CO2 out of thin air, right?
And are we doing that?
Are we close to doing that? Well, we've been doing it forever, right? Trees have been doing it forever, right? Sort of the natural version, if you will.
We plant trees?
Yes, of course, right? I like trees. Trees are fun. Trees are good. We can use more trees. Yes, absolutely. Trees the solution? No. Now, for a few reasons. So one, of course, right? So there are land use trade-offs here, very direct ones. Right? Limited land and so on, of course. Another one is trees keep the CO2 in the biosphere, right? They suck the CO2 out of the atmosphere, which is good, but then trees die, decompose, and the CO2 is released back into the air, right? So really what we should want to do is take the CO2 out of the atmosphere, out of the biosphere, and put it back where it came from, back into the geosphere, back underground. And yes, there too are in fact carbon removal technologies that allow that. They sort of literally, we can basically reverse the chemical processes that we use to, right, burn fossil fuels, release CO2, to take the CO2 out of thin air and put it back on the ground. Now, okay, that sounds energetically expensive and monetarily expensive, right? It costs a lot of money right now, and it does. So there's, for example, a demonstration plant right now, a Swiss startup, Climeworks, has a plant up in Iceland, Orca plant, that takes something like 4,000 tons or so of CO2 out of the atmosphere in a year at the low, low price of somewhere around $1,000, 1,000 euros, actually, per ton of CO2, right? Okay, that's very expensive relative to, frankly, what most of us are willing to pay to offset our own emissions or cut our own emissions. So one way to look at carbon removal is, in fact, a simply expensive mitigation, an expensive way to cut CO2 emissions, right? So in other words, there is lots and lots of other things we could and should be doing now before we get there. And now we're back to the clean energy race. That said, right, if we want to be at a stage in a 2-3 decades to be sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere at scale, we better start now. We better pay, you know, are willing to pay $1,000 a ton today to get it down to $500, $200, $100 per ton of CO2 sooner rather than later.
I mean, isn't there a risk, or at least I've heard it phrased as a risk, that if you spend a lot of time and energy on carbon capture and sequestration that is storing it, that you're going to take away from what should be our fundamental challenge, which is simply not to put the emissions in the air in the first place. And in some sense, what'll happen is it will just encourage us to put more heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere.
Absolutely. I mean, the risk often goes under the name of moral hazard, right? It basically allows us...
Like car insurance and you drive faster.
Exactly, right? Or you put on your seatbelt and you drive faster, right? And sort of in many ways, yes, that phenomenon exists. It, you know, it's ever present, if you will. And, you know, to be clear, some of this moral hazard is good, right? As in, you know, getting places faster is in fact a feature, not a flaw, right? So if you driving with a seatbelt means that you get there faster and more safely, great, right? But of course, right, you know, some of these conversations get very controversial very quickly, right? And, you know, sort of not to get too political, but, you know, the political right basically often points to health insurance, right? You know, universal healthcare, right? As sort of, oh, that creates all this moral hazard. It's the government taking care of you when you get sick. Shouldn't you be, you know, taking care of your own body, kind of? Or for that matter, you know, reproductive technologies, right? Condoms, right? Is sort of your classic moral hazard technology.
You were the first person to mention the word condom on the President's Inbox.
On this podcast? Okay, well, let me shift immediately from condoms to solar geoengineering or carbon removal, because, yeah, it has the same features, right? There's a technology that we know works, right? It does work. The condoms work as advertised, turns out. Now, you know, if you don't like the behavior that leads you to need to use condoms, right, then you may object to it on the grounds of moral hazard, right, because it allows stuff that you find icky to happen safely. Well, back to carbon removal. Yeah, same idea, right? You know, now it's not the political right, now it's the political left, if you will, right, who might object to carbon removal as a technology because it allows us to keep burning fossil fuels. But, and just to be clear, it of course gets much, much more complicated very quickly, right? First of all, who is the us here, right? Who is the we? It's not like that there's some benevolent, omniscient decision maker, right, who makes some sort of rational decision of what the right mix is of burning fossil fuels now versus sucking CO2 back out, right? No, of course not, right? It's vested interests that are going to, you know, spam your Twitter feed with ads telling you how great carbon removal technologies are, and, you know, sort of subconsciously wanting you to believe that, oh, fossil fuels are not that much a problem after all, because look, we can all, you know, technology already exists, we can suck it back up.
Gaynor, is that why energy companies, fossil fuel companies have invested so heavily in carbon capture?
In part, yes, of course, right? I mean, okay, and now there, right, there's sort of definitely two sides to this, right? So if you had to pick a company that you would think is best equipped to, in fact, just do the technical problem, right? Scale up the technology, finance it, go do it, right? Suck CO2 back out of thin air. It's presumably the companies that already have the pipelines, right? The companies that have the technology, that have dealt with carbon for a century, right? Of their existence and so on. And to basically, you know, convert energy, oil and gas companies, right, into carbon management companies that sooner rather than later do in fact start sucking CO2 out of thin air, right? Sure. On the other hand, of course, it now allows, you know, Exxon to sponsor a Reuters news story about this Climeworks demonstration plant in Iceland I just mentioned on my Twitter feed. Like, literally, right? Sort of hundreds, thousands of views for this video that Reuters produced, news agency produced, about this Climeworks demonstration plant. And on the very bottom of that sponsored Twitter ad, it says, sponsored by Exxon. So yes, it is a problem, right? When vested interest basically promotes this technology in hopes of us easing off climate policies and not instituting the sort of policies that would lead us to cut fossil fuel use in the first place. And you know, that now gets very complicated, right? Because very quickly, because it is no longer the case that there's some sort of rational decision maker trying to balance here the benefits and the costs, but basically it's a for-profit enterprise trying to keep the status quo longer in order to squeeze in yet another quarterly earnings call before the carbon tax, the carbon price, the regulation hits. And yes, of course, right? Frankly, that goes now well beyond moral hazard, right? It is no longer the economist's definition of moral hazard, where you, as the rational human being, now react to a rule that forces you to use seatbelts in a way that you drive faster, right? But now it's different decision makers, vested interests competing in the marketplace of ideas, competing in Washington, their lobbying efforts, and so on.
So let's talk about solar geoengineering. What role does that play? What state is the technology in? What are the moral hazards that arise when we talk about solar geoengineering?
So the moral hazards are very similar to nuclear on the one hand, carbon removal on the other. The technology itself is very different. So solar geoengineering essentially is an attempt to brighten the planet at a large scale, to cool it, to intervene directly by basically changing the planet's albedo, its brightness.
The idea is to reflect radiation coming from the sun back out in space.
Exactly, to reflect back, right? So you can sort of, in a very simple term, you can sort of think of it, why do we wear white between Memorial and Labor Day? And why are winter coats black? Black absorbs the heat, the energy, warms what is underneath. White reflects and cools what is underneath.
And obviously, with the melting of the polar ice caps, you have a decrease in the Earth's albedo.
You do, and that's a very negative feedback effect, right? Because now you increase global warming even more so, because suddenly the poles are less bright. And yeah, so at a global level, maybe the most prominent solar geoengineering technology, if you will, is mimicking volcanoes. When Mount Pinatubo erupts in the Philippines in 1991 and releases quite a bit of gunk into the stratosphere, global average temperatures in 1992, ironically, right around the time of the Rio Earth Summit, right, the first time we all got together in June, July 1992, global average temperatures were about half a degree centigrade, almost a degree Fahrenheit, cooler than they would have been without the volcanic eruption. Now, there's a few things here. So one, that stuff falls out again, those aerosols, tiny reflective particles, sulfate aerosols in this case, fall out. And sort of 18 months later, global average temperatures are back to where they would have been entirely without the volcanic eruption. And of course, temperatures have risen ever since. That's one, you know, feature of this potential intervention that some might consider a problem. I would consider, in fact, to be a feature, right? It's sort of a, unlike CO2, where 40% of the CO2 we emit today is still there 1,000 years from now. With stratospheric aerosols, with solar geoengineering, you, in some sense, have much more control over what happens. Or for that matter, if you don't like it and you stop 18 months later, it's gone. Nah. Nothing ever is as simple as this, simplistic description might lead you to believe. But yes, that's certainly a feature of this intervention that is, in fact, good, I would say, this controllability. Now, what's not good, of course, is that there are plenty of risks associated with this potential intervention.
What would those risks be?
Frankly, one is moral hazard, right? That's, of course, not the sort of risk that you first think about because you would think of physical risks first. But I would say, actually, maybe the most important risk overall in its overall impact might, in fact, be this moral hazard component of solar geoengineering, right? Us, you and me talking about it, right? Mere fact that we now spend the time talking about solar geoengineering and not solar panels, right? Others might say, you're taking the eyes off the ball here, right? You're not focused on what you should be focused on. Now, in terms of physical risks, I would say the more one studies this, the better it seems to look, in the sense that, yes, there are physical risks. There is, for example, an interaction of these sulfate aerosols with stratospheric ozone, right? With the ozone, the protective ozone layer in the stratosphere. And yes, when Pinatubo erupted, the ozone hole over the Antarctic opened up a bit again. That's a problem. Of course it is.
And it's a problem because?
Because we like stratospheric ozone. We don't like it down here. We don't like it in LA because of all the traffic. But we like ozone in the stratosphere because it is this protective layer that, by the way, we worked very, very hard in the late 80s to pass the Montreal Protocol, to ratify the Montreal Protocol, and to basically begin this healing process of the stratosphere, phase out the offending substances, and fix the ozone hole. Solar geoengineering wouldn't reopen the ozone hole, but it would delay the healing process. If you were to do solar geoengineering with sulfate aerosols, with sulfur. Turns out there might be the potential to use different substances, calcium carbonate, tested in a lab, modeled in climate model runs by now, might have even better optical properties than sulfate aerosols. So it might be doing better on that front. And it's a base, not an acid. It doesn't muck with the ozone hole. If anything, it leads to what's sometimes called ozone super recovery, right? Like suddenly you get too much of the ozone, which of course is its own risk. All that's to say is, yes, there is a lot more research to be done on this topic.
Have we actually done research on this? My sense is that there's a lot of resistance to conducting large-scale tests of what critics call geoengineering, what proponents would call things like solar radiation management or solar climate intervention.
So we haven't done any outdoor experiments or, little ones here and there, but sort of nothing of significance. There are hundreds of peer-reviewed papers by now, most of them focused on climate model runs. So, has there been research on this topic? Yes, absolutely. And actually, most of it happened over the last decade or so. There was basically, the idea has been around for a while, since the 60s, 70s. But there was basically a longstanding self-imposed moratorium, if you will, by scientists, by climate scientists. And I would once again point to moral hazard as taking front of the blame here. Climate scientists basically self-censoring because they were afraid of this moral hazard component, right? Taking eyes off the ball, needing to cut CO2 emissions in the first place. Now, interestingly enough, who broke this taboo? Well, who helped break the taboo in a big way? It was the late, great Paul Crutzen, who won the Nobel Prize, shared the Nobel Prize for work leading up to the Montreal Protocol, to the discovery of the ozone hole and then the work to fix it. And he basically wrote this speculative essay 15 or so years ago by now that basically said, wait, we have way too much local air pollution killing millions of people down here. If we were to stop that, and of course we should, the planet would warm quite a bit very quickly because that air pollution down here is also mostly in form of tiny reflective particles cooling the planet, right? So he sort of wrote this essay basically asking the question, wouldn't it be a reasonable thing to want to do to both cut the pollution down here and at the same time deliberately introduce a small fraction of that pollution into the stratosphere where nobody lives, of course, where it has much fewer health effects, negative health effects, basically in an attempt to stabilize temperatures while we clean up the mess down here that local air pollution causes, right? And in some sense that, the fact that Mr. Ozone Hole, right, won the Nobel Prize for the discovery and so on, would write this, would speculate that this might be a trade-off worth contemplating, in some sense broke this long-standing taboo, self-imposed moratorium of research. And in the last 10, 15 years, we've seen this exponential increase in attention paid to this topic. And by now we have hundreds, 800 or so last count, peer-reviewed papers on this topic.
So the argument for solar radiation management is that in theory, it could buy time to actually have the green transition fully go forth. The risk is that if it succeeded, that you might never actually make that transition because you'd be protected by this solar radiation management.
So I would say I don't quite buy the sort of buying time argument here, because at the end of the day, right, we just have to race as fast as possible and toward this clean energy future, full stop. But that's, priorities 1 through 10, right? This climate policy are cut CO2 emissions, right? Insulate, 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 electrify, 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 decarbonize the grid, and so on and so forth. What solar geoengineering might in fact do, and again, at this point, we are sort of at the stage where we ought to be doing more research on this topic. It's not about deploying it next year or anytime soon. It's doing the research. But what it might do is, it might actually save quite a few people right now while we are in the stage where we have not cut CO2 emissions sufficiently, where we have warmed the planet by over a degree centigrade, 2 degrees Fahrenheit already, and where we do see floods devastating Pakistan with 1,000 people dead this week and 10 to 30 million people affected, right? And droughts in China and heat wave in Europe and the Western US burning and so on and so forth, right? So there are plenty of bad effects already. Climate change is already hitting home. And yes, on balance, right, this is a risk-risk trade-off conversation here. Maybe solar geoengineering could in fact do quite a bit of good right now, not as a replacement for cutting CO2 emissions, but largely because we have, in fact, warmed the planet by over a degree centigrade, 2 degrees Fahrenheit already. And because climate impacts, climate damages are already hitting home.
On that sobering note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Gernot Wagner, a climate economist at Columbia University's Business School. Gernot, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And leave us a review. We love the feedback. You can find the books and articles mentioned in this episode, as well as a transcript of our conversation, on the podcast page for the President's Inbox on CFR.org. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Rafaela Siewert with senior podcast producer Gabrielle Sierra. Rafaela was our recording engineer. Thank you, Raf. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.